in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Is it possible to delay or reverse memory decline? That's one of the questions we'll take up this afternoon in this portion of the program. Memory is our topic. Jill Einstein and Mark McDaniel join us to answer our questions about memory and aging. They are psychologists and the authors of the new book, Memory Fitness, A Guide for Successful Aging. The authors begin this book with a look at all our memories give us. Memories can bring happiness, remembering your first kiss, for example. They also point out that life as we know it would be impossible without memory. As we age and we find ourselves forgetting something, though, we may feel a little panicky. But we should keep this in perspective. Let me quote from the book, Memory Fitness. People, especially older people, tend to be critical of their own ability to remember. They view memory as weak and fragile. The fact that we forget things annoys us, but we rarely acknowledge the vast archive of information we have successfully stored and can recall. Think of your knowledge of the town where you live. Your mental maps enable you to easily get where you want to go. Think of all the faces you recognize daily, including those of your family, your friends, actors, and politicians. Think of your vocabulary, the thousands of words you're able to use. Think of all the odors and tastes you can identify. Now try remembering the number of windows that were on the front of the house you lived in when you were a child. Most people can do this by generating a mental image of the house and then actually counting the number of windows in that image. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon. Give us a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. In the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Jill Einstein is professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Furman University. Mark McDaniel is chair of the psychology department at the University of New Mexico. Their book, Memory Fitness, A Guide for Successful Aging, is published by the Yale University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Jill Einstein, Mark McDaniel, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be on the air with you. Thank you, Celeste.
You're very welcome. To what extent does aging affect the brain and our ability to remember?
Well, there are quite a few effects of aging on the brain. It used to be thought, though, that the effects on the brain were more severe than they actually are. The early studies that were done seemed to indicate massive loss of neurons with aging, but it turns out that when they did the autopsies, they included a lot of brains that were diseased, that had Alzheimer's disease. And what they're finding now, through normal aging, that the effects are not as devastating as originally thought, and there's not a whole lot of neuronal loss. But there are some noticeable changes. For example, there are fewer neurotransmitters in the brain as you get older, reduced levels of neurotransmitters, and that's the chemical messengers between neurons. There's some shrinkage of the neurons. There's some slowing of the neurons. So there are some measurable effects of aging on the brain.
Yeah. Now, who did we just hear from?
You heard from Jill Einstein.
Okay. Thank you.
And Celeste, I might add that with decreased functionality in synapses due to loss of neurotransmitter, part of the reason for loss of functionality. That seems to be associated then maybe with problems in accessing the memories as easily as we once did.
Yeah.
So perhaps some of the retrieval problems that people find they have in recovering a name or so on may be related to the fact that we lose some functionality in the network of synapses that support memory.
Yeah. It was interesting, though, to realize or to learn from your book, Memory Fitness, that there is an area of memory that older people seem to be better at in general than younger people, and that's something called semantic memory.
That's right. All the tests show that your knowledge improves as you get older. And so if you give a vocabulary test, for example, to 20-year-olds who are in college and compare their vocabulary with that of 60 and 70 and 80-year-olds, the older adults tend to do better on those kinds of tests. Mm. So that's the reassuring thing.
Mm-hmm. What other kinds of memory are there? We mentioned now semantic memory. What other kinds of memory do we have?
Well, Celeste, we have a memory that we call working memory, which is kind of our mental sketch pad, and that's where we hold information in awareness for a limited period of time so that we can work with that information, solve problems with that information, reason with that information, and that is a type of memory that tends to decline with age. We also have kind of a memory system called episodic memory, which is where we store memories of autobiographical information, information that's tied to particular time, information that's tied to particular spatial context. And it's pretty clear that episodic memory tends to decline with older adults, especially acquiring new information.
Hmm.
There's also some slowing that occurs with age, which can have an impact on memory. So if you're a little bit slower at retrieving the information, keeping it activated, you're not going to be able to keep as many thoughts activated in your mental sketchpad at any one time.
Yeah. You know, teachers and parents know children have different styles of learning. Does that indicate that there are some differences in memory and how we remember from one individual to another?
There probably are differences, individual differences in how we approach learning tasks. For example, imagery is a wonderful benefit for memory. So for most people, if they image something, it really improves their memory. But that doesn't work for all people. And I think there are some people who have difficulty imaging, so they have to use different techniques in order to improve their memory. So, yeah, there are individual differences. And one of the themes of our book, really, is that as you age, you might have to change or compensate in some ways for the changes that occur with aging. So, Celeste, I might give you one example. As we age, it in some cases it seems to be the case that we're not quite as able to remember intentions of activities or little chores that we might want to perform later on. For example, take a library book back to the library.
Mm-hmm.
And studies have shown that some older adults tend to be aware of that change, and to compensate, they construct external cues in their environment. So, for example, an older person who might want to remember to take a library book back could lean the library book against the door so that they have an obvious, explicit cue to remind them of that intention. And so, yeah, I think as we age, we do find that there are ways to compensate for some decline in things that were easier when we were younger.
Yeah. We'll talk more about that, I think, as the hour progresses.
Okay.
But I want to talk with a listener now who's waiting for us in Indiana on our toll-free line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Two questions, I believe. One is in terms of statistics. I don't know what age group you do from 80 to 100 or 70 to whatever, but is it a normal bell curve in terms of retention, average, then really bad shape? Second question is, Where I live, I'm near Purdue University, this sort of general scuttlebutt is that if a person has Alzheimer's, or at least the proto-Alzheimer's before it becomes full-blown, is that the most recent memories are bad, and that they can remember rather well things that occurred to them when they were, you know, much, much younger. And I wonder if that is true, and if that is true, what kind of memory is that? Thank you.
Okay.
I'll answer the first question first, and that is that the memory decline tends to be very gradual. So if you bring people in who are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and you give them a variety of memory tests, you tend to show gradual declines that start in the 30s and progressively get worse as people get older. Now, if you look at any individual age group, I think you will find something that approximates a bell-shaped curve where the average person is going to have a certain kind of memory. But there are folks who are in their 80s who have really fantastic memory and better memory than folks in their 20s. So you are going to see that variability within each age group.
And I'd like to add to that, clearly the listener knows a little bit about statistics. So the curve will be bell-shaped, but an interesting aspect is that as we look at older and older adults, the variability of that curve increases. So that is that with younger adults, there's a little less variance in their performance, and as we age, you tend to see much more spread, so that you'll find some older adults who are doing pretty well, and then you'll find a big spread of older adults who at various stages of loss. So that's an interesting feature as well.
Yeah. How is memory tested in...
I think we have one more question, and that was about Alzheimer's.
Yes. I'm sorry. I forgot.
And yes, that's right. We tend to lose the more recent memories first, and memories that were formed earlier on tend to be more resistant to loss. And not clear why that is, although it's probably the case that the newer memories are not as somehow not as strong. They're not as well encoded in the network of neurons that help support memory. They're not as rehearsed as much as the earlier memories. There may not be the pictures and the stories associated with them. So hard to know exactly why, but it is true that that's the tendency.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know an older woman who... It's wonderful to talk with about the past, and she's wonderful with song lyrics and all kinds of information, but things that have happened recently, that information doesn't hang in there.
Yeah, that's correct.
One way to think about that is that your system is a little more efficient and effective at storing information when you're younger than when you're older. So these memories were stored with a younger memory system, and they tend to be a little more durable than the memories that are being stored later on in life.
Hmm. How is memory tested and measured?
Oh, there are a variety of ways to test memory, but one type of memory that Mark mentioned earlier is episodic memory, and that's a measure of your ability to learn something new and associated with a particular context. So you might give people a list of words, a list of pairs of words, like tell people the word train goes with cold, the word dog goes with table. So you give them those pairs. After giving them 20 or so pairs, you might introduce a delay and then present the first word in each pair and ask them to retrieve the second word. That's a fairly standard way to measure memory. Another way would be to give people simply a list of words, and then afterwards give them what's called a free recall test. The first test was a cued recall test, where you're given a cue at retrieval. The second test would be a free recall test, where you simply ask them to recall everything. And it turns out that people have greater problems when they're given that free recall test, when they're not given cues.
Mm-hmm.
And as you age, you're more and more dependent on those cues. So you get larger age differences with a free recall test than with a cued recall test.
And Celeste,
yeah.
You raise a good point there. We can even extend it to now a recognition test where the words on the list are given with other words that weren't on the list, and someone has to make a decision about whether the word was on the list or not, a recognition test. And what one finds is that how one measures memory really has a big influence on whether or not older adults are going to show some decline. So with recognition tests, there's not much decline with older adults. Cued recall tests a little bit more decline, and free recall is most challenging for older adults. So how one measures memory is very important.
Yeah. Throughout the book, there are many interesting tests. And the one that comes to mind at the moment is something that's called the penny demonstration.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, for people who are listening this afternoon, if someone hands you a penny, you know immediately what it is. But if you had to describe it, you know, how accurately could you really tell someone else what exactly that penny looks like? What's involved there in the recognition this is a penny, but at the same time our inability to be really specific about what a penny looks like?
Well, that, Celeste, you touch on another really interesting point about memory, and that is that one of the things we talk about in the book is that some people may hold the notion that memory is like a tape recorder and faithfully records every detail that we're exposed to. And, in fact, memory probably isn't like that. Memory is something that records meaning and records schemas and the general gist of events. And we don't faithfully record or remember the exact details. So in looking at a penny, you may not be recording those exact details. You may have a general idea of a penny as a small coin that's made of copper and that's brown and that has some value. And memory tends to record those things that work at that level than necessarily a faithful recording of every detail.
In fact, Celeste, it would probably be very easy to slip you a counterfeit penny because we tend not to analyze the details of the things that we're processing or perceiving. This is a very interesting study that was done a couple years ago in which they got a confederate of the experimenter to go up to a person on campus, and I think it was done at the University of Illinois, actually. And what they did was to ask this person directions. And while the person was giving the confederate the directions on campus, they had two other confederates of the experimenter rudely interrupt the two folks who were talking, walk through with a door, and one of the Confederates switched places with the first Confederate who had asked the questions. And what they were interested in was whether people would notice that a switch had been made, whether this person would notice that he was giving directions to a different person. And it turns out, remarkably, that only in about half of the cases did people notice that now they were talking to somebody else. The point of the research really was that when we meet people and we're having a very brief encounter, we do a very superficial encoding and don't process all the details of a person's face. Now, if this happened to be somebody that you thought was very attractive, and you might do more processing of the features.
Yeah.
But if in normal interactions, brief interactions, we don't do a whole lot of processing necessarily. We do a functional encoding.
Yeah. Well, that's all we need, really, isn't it?
In most cases,
In
yeah.
most cases.
Yeah.
Right. Gil Einstein and Mark McDaniel are our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with them today about memory. They are the authors of Memory Fitness, A Guide for Successful Aging. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have another listener on the toll-free line joining us this afternoon. This caller is in Homewood. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Something you just made me think. I was in Vietnam, and some of the memories associated with that are so vivid down to the detail. My, like, for example, I've traveled around the world and had some very pleasant experiences, but those vacations are kind of like looking in a photograph album. The memories from the war are like, you know, reliving it. You can feel it. You can smell it. The temperature of the air, the wind on your face. When those memories come back, they're very different than the other kind that the rest of life is made of.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've run into that or not.
Well, we haven't studied that particularly in our laboratory, but there is research on memories associated with strong emotions, and it tends to be the case that some of those memories are very vivid, can be very vivid. And so that's not what you mention is not unusual. Some theory behind that is that for highly emotional events, more of the brain gets involved, more of the limbic system, the emotional part of the brain gets involved and reinforces the kinds of processes that produce memories, so that you really do have more neural activity, more brain involvement in those events, and thus the memories do tend to be stronger and more vivid.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Orland Park, line one. Hi.
Hello. I wanted to get back to your notion of that type of memory that is like a sketch pad. I think you said scratch pad?
Yes, yeah.
I'm only in my early 50s, and because of the kind of technical work that I do, it's very clear to me that type of memory is faulty relative to just a few years ago. The kind of work that I do is more like you might imagine unraveling puzzles, or if you were doing a crossword puzzle without a pencil, the amount of related information you try to carry in your head for a period of time, well, that would be similar to the processing in my kind of work. As of now, I'm very short compared to just a few years ago in that kind of memory, and the question I have is, I've been unable to find any books, methods for tuning that up, or I wouldn't know where to find a clinic with researchers who would look into that or something. The nearest I've found around us is seems like the disease of the month is sleep disorders, and the remedy there is usually a treatment for breathing difficulties. Certainly, my memory is poorer when I'm short of sleep, but I think that's a roundabout way. I'm really looking for tools or methods, and wondering if your book or if you know researchers who are working and have techniques for boosting up that scratch pad memory.
I think that's a great question. And first, let me give you a general point that we think is very important, and that is that with normal aging, you're going to notice memory decline. And a lot of people take it a step further. There's so much news these days about Alzheimer's disease, and they often wonder whether these signs of memory changes are the initial signs of Alzheimer's disease. In fact, we did a study at my university where we sent out a survey and asked people to indicate their age, and also to answer the question, have you ever, with any feeling of sincerity, had the idea that you might have the initial stages of Alzheimer's disease?
Uh-huh.
And what was remarkable was that starting in the 30s and 40s, about a third of the people indicated that was the case. And it turns out that the actual incidence of a disease like that is much less than 1%. So one general point that we make in our book that we think is important for people to realize is that they're going to notice memory changes, but in the vast majority of cases, those memory changes are the result of normal aging, what's normally happening as you age, and not the initial signs of something that is more sinister. Now, what can you do in terms of working memory? We have several ideas, and Mark can start off.
Yeah, we do address that in the book. And one thing is that
as we age, it appears as if we're not as good at inhibiting distracting kinds of things, which does create some functional loss in the sketch pad. So one thing you can do is when you're trying to do that kind of work, make sure that you're completely free of distraction. So coworkers' conversation should be somehow, you try to prevent that. Music, distracting noise, distracting thoughts, distracting concerns that you might have. Try to somehow put those at rest before you try to engage your sketch pad in the kind of work you're doing. And another thing that we suggest, and you can read about in the book, is that as we age, it turns out that we have some times of the day that are not as optimal. The circadian, we're more sensitive to the circadian rhythms. And as we age, we tend to do pretty well at our optimal times of day, but we falter the most, especially on the kind of activity you're talking about, at non-optimal times of the day. And in the book, we have a questionnaire that's used quite widely to determine your optimal time of day. And what we suggest is for people who are expressing concerns like you and in jobs like you, get that work done that involves your sketch pad at your optimal time of day.
And Mark and I have taken that advice to heart. We were just talking earlier today how both of us schedule our difficult work in the morning. We're both morning people, and we schedule our writing, which requires major concentration. We need to be able to inhibit distraction, and we schedule that in the morning, whereas things that are less demanding, let's say analyzing data, something that's relatively automatic for us, we can do that any time of the day.
And I'll add one more thing that's a little bit more speculative. We do have a whole chapter on nutritional supplements,
right.
Supplements that are very popular these days for presumably helping to improve memory. And there is an amino acid that tends to suggest that it helps energy transport and production in neurons. And I'm not pushing this particular thing, but it's possible that for certain people, these kinds of supplements, which don't require prescription and seem relatively safe, it might be worth a try. One's acetyl-L-carnitine tends to, in some studies, not very many, and it's not completely proven yet, but it may increase concentration, and it may help that mental state.
Let me ask a short follow-up, and then I'll take my answer off the air. After I read your book, and because I read this kind of thing from time to time, after I read your book, where would it be that I would keep up on progress in this field? Who's writing or what clinics are doing research in this field? And if maybe during the next few minutes you can talk about how we would keep up on what I think is going to become a more and more important issue to more people, that would be helpful.
That's a great question. We have information in the book about that, and we'll tell you a little bit about that right now, too.
There are great websites through the National Institute of Health, NIH, and also the National Institute on Aging, NIA. So if you look at those websites, you can keep up with a lot of the current information that's coming out.
Okay, very good.
I'd like to add one other thing.
Sure.
About the mental sketch pad. Another thing that is often overlooked is to rely more on notes. So if you have to keep three or four things in mind when you're working on a problem, jot down the notes. There's some interesting work that's been done showing that if you give surveys to older adults and you present the survey auditorily, they're very influenced by the order of the questions, because they can't keep all the items in mind, all the alternatives in mind. And you get very different results if you present it auditorily versus visually, where they can more easily consider all of the alternatives. So as you age, one thing that changes is your working memory capacity, your mental sketch pad, and one way to compensate for that is simply to take notes and have and look at all those components and keep them activated through these external cues.
Right. So the idea is make that mental sketch pad more of an external sketch pad.
Yeah.
If you can.
Yeah. So, in other words, in addition maybe to putting the library book next to the door, maybe you're going to have a list of things when you get out of bed in the morning and you sit down to have breakfast. Maybe you've got a list.
That would be a great thing to do.
Of things.
And, in fact, in naturalistic studies where they look at that kind of remembering in the real world, older adults do at least as well, if not better, than younger adults because they've learned to compensate. They rely more on calendars and lists and those kinds of techniques.
Yeah. So another thing that I have found is it really helps me to have a pad of paper and a calendar next to the telephone.
That's perfect, Celeste. Although yeah. It doesn't sound like you're at that age range where you need that all that much at this point.
No, occasionally I do, believe me. I have a funny story to tell about myself. Some months ago, my husband and I cleaned out the kitchen cupboards and we went to put things back. And I said, no, these platters go over here. And he said, well, no, they don't. And you know what? He was right. It wasn't until I went to get them to use them that I realized, no, we moved them, and I insisted that we were going to put them in the wrong place, and they went back, you know. But so it wasn't until I actually used the muscles to go over to the cabinet to retrieve those plates. So it was rather embarrassing, and I had to apologize, but I wasn't too worried about it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a little bit like the penny example.
Mm-hmm.
That it's something that you really didn't process the location all that much. Your body did as it went to reach for the plates, but you didn't visually process it all that much.
Yeah. Well, the gentleman who called in and said that he had served in Vietnam, combat is a very intense situation, and sometimes, you know, those kinds of memories are really going to stay with you. On the other hand, don't we have a tendency, or can't we have a tendency, to take something that was very intense and kind of want to, I don't know if erase it is the right word, but...
Repress it?
Yeah. So you could have two responses to a very intense situation.
Celeste, you've hit a very controversial issue. Memory researchers are debating vigorously at this time whether or not those kinds of memories actually can be repressed and erased, and there's a vigorous debate on that right now.
Yeah.
So that's something to keep an eye on for the future, but it's a very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that debate surrounds the issue of recovered memories of childhood sexual abuse.
Yeah, you write about that in the book, which is very interesting.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people who recover in middle age the idea that they were abused as children. And one theory that dates back to Freud is that traumatic events are repressed to the unconscious, and then later on, there's some energy associated with them, symptoms emerge, and eventually they become conscious again and you recover them. But another way of thinking about that is that perhaps these events never occurred, but that there are some therapists out there who believe that childhood sexual abuse is rampant and that it occurs at epidemic proportions. And some people feel that maybe they implant these memories in their patients or clients.
Yeah.
And the laboratory data does show that you can create memories in people, and you can get them to feel these memories were very real.
Yeah. Well, something you said earlier that I thought was interesting when we were talking about memories that are older, that things that we remember from when we were younger, we've had an opportunity to rehearse them. That's very interesting. And at the same time, as you point out in Memory Fitness, this was wonderful to think about. Our mind retains information in a fairly literal state for at most 2 seconds. So memories are very dynamic.
They are. And... One of the most revealing studies to me was a study that was done at Emory University several years ago, and what they did was to get college freshmen the day after the Space Shuttle Challenger accident, and they asked them what they were doing when they heard about the Space Shuttle Challenger accident, because for most people that was a monumental event, and they the thinking was that they would remember what they were doing later on. And so they gathered these people again 2.5 years later, and they asked them if they remembered what they were doing when they heard of the Space Shuttle Challenger accident. And with great confidence, they said, yes, I remember exactly what I was doing. And they had them write down what they were doing. And then they compared their memory at the actual time with their current memory of what they were doing. And what they found was in about 50% of the cases, major distortions. And what was really interesting about that was that there were these great distortions, yet the person felt so confident about his or her current memory that they often said, well, I must have been wrong the first time. Because we have these memories, we have these experiences, we think about them later on, and they become modified, and they become very real. They're still very real, even though they're not exactly what happened earlier.
Yeah.
And Celeste, I'd like to respond to another part of what you said in terms of earlier memories being rehearsed. And essentially, that's a situation where one calls those items out of memory, that is, we can say retrieves the items from memory. And it turns out that retrieval is a very powerful way to kind of cement memories in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a technique that is so potent that it's been used with Alzheimer's patients to help them remember things.
Mm.
That is, to force the patient to retrieve information that they need to know initially, right away, and then ask the same question a little bit later and extend the retrieval interval. And if you do that, extend that interval to about 5 minutes, that retrieval practice has for Alzheimer's patients, allowed them to remember information. So a little an actual story of a person who used this with his mother. He'd take her to an Alzheimer's clinic, and he'd say, we're going to school today. And the mother would ask the son every couple seconds, where are we going?
Mm-hmm.
The son would say, Mom, we're going to school. And he got a little frustrated. But he had read about this retrieval technique that I'm talking about. So what he did one day was he said, after he told his mother we're going to school, he said, Mom, where are we going? And she said, well, we're going to school. And then he waited 10 to 15 seconds later and said, Mom, where are we going? And she looked at him a little alarmed and said, well, son, I just told you. And then he waited a minute and asked. And she said, I'm kind of getting sick of this. We're going to school. And so after using that technique, he could then get her to remember they're going to school, and she stopped pestering him about it. So in many ways, early memories are probably one reason they're probably remembered well is we've retrieved them often, and that retrieval really cements the information in them.
Yeah. Well, we opened up this morning with a little bit of sentimental journey. I think that's at work as well. Let's talk with another listener this afternoon on line one in Savoy. Good afternoon.
Yes. I'm interested whether anesthetic for surgery and so on temporarily affects memory. I'll hang up.
Okay. Good
question. Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that it does interfere with memory. Most of the evidence shows that the effect is temporary, but there's some somewhat frightening reports with heart bypass surgery that the effects persist for as long as 5 years after surgery or even more. So there are effects of anesthetic surgery.
What about stress? A little stress is a good thing. But a lot of stress just stops us dead in our tracks. How does stress affect memory?
Well, we believe that one way that it affects memory is it takes up that working memory capacity. So as you're stressed, as you're anxious, that takes up a lot of working memory capacity. So you have less capacity left over to really pay attention and think about what you are learning and to try to retrieve information from memory. And I tell a story in the book, which is an absolutely true story, of one of my students who took my general psychology course and failed the first test, and then came to see me about how to study more effectively so she could do better on the test. And I said, well, come and study with me. And I worked with her a couple days a week, and she took the second test, and she failed that one too. And I said, well, maybe you have to really develop these learning techniques. So she studied with me again and took the third test and failed that as well. And then she stopped coming to see me. She learned that I was not helping her out. But then she made a B on the fourth test and made a B on the final exam without coming to see me. And I talked to her afterwards, and she said that I asked her, well, what did you do? And she said, well, turns out I was so anxious that that's what was interfering with my performance. And I went to see my physician, and he gave me something to calm me down. And that's how she improved her performance. She didn't change her studying style. She knew it all along, but just couldn't perform under those very stressful conditions.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I've been reading in the papers that there have been some breakthroughs as far as a pharmaceutical fix for people who are losing their memories, and particularly with Alzheimer's. And I was just wondering if you think that if you know very much about that, if you think people might, just ordinary people might jump on it like they have with Viagra, you know, and try to improve their memories, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I think there's tremendous progress in thinking about some pharmaceutical treatments of Alzheimer's, but I don't think I wouldn't say right now we've got huge breakthroughs. I've been following some of that, and I think Aricept is a drug for Alzheimer's that they're suggesting if someone's taking that and hasn't yet developed Alzheimer's but looks like they're show the signs to be in danger of developing it, the Aricept seems to prevent that, the more damaging kinds of memory loss, for maybe 6 months, and then it stops working. So there are ways maybe to forestall temporarily the onset of some of these severe memory losses, but right now there's no cure. There are some provocative kinds of things. There's work with an antibiotic that's not been used for a while because it tends to leach minerals and copper out of the body, but it turns out that with Alzheimer's patients, there's some suggestion that the leaching of the copper is helping them maintain neuron function. So I think there's some exciting research going on, but I don't think at this point we've got a breakthrough that can be said to be a cure or necessarily something that people don't have developed memory problems would want to go out and take in terms of prescribed drugs.
Yeah.
There is some research with substances, naturally occurring substances like ginkgo and phosphatidylserine, which is a phospholipid that's very important for neuron health, a natural substance in quercetin that comes from the periwinkle plant that helps blood flow. So there are some natural substances that may be good for brain health that older adults who don't have any memory problems might take to maintain neuron function, but there are no scientific studies yet that have looked at normal older adults taking these substances and long-term effects in terms of forestalling memory problems. So there's some interesting substances that theoretically would have good benefits, but at this point we can't say that scientifically we know they're going to help. But again, we cover that in our book in a chapter, and they may be worth a try.
Yeah.
Something that would be effective, at least to some extent, is physical exercise. I know you asked about nutrients, but there is fairly recent and very convincing evidence that physical exercise, and it doesn't have to be extensive, can lead to improvements in the cognitive functions that are most at risk for did was to get one group that did toning exercises for a six-month period, 3 days a week. Another group did aerobic exercises, 3 days a week of brisk walking for 45 minutes. And after a six-month period, the group that did the aerobic conditioning not only had better cardiovascular health, but they also were better on certain kinds of memory tasks that are most at risk for aging.
And in addition, general cardiovascular health seems to relate to Alzheimer's in as much as some studies have shown that women with high levels of HDL, the good cholesterol, tend years later not to show as much dementia and Alzheimer's as women with not high levels of HDL. And in addition, studies have been done with large-based population studies relating to the people taking statins, which are the anti-cholesterol drugs. One such brand is Lipitor. And there tends to be an association between those on Lipitor and less incidence of Alzheimer's. So cardiovascular health, cholesterol, those things do seem to be related, and it might be worth looking into trying to find ways to lower that bad cholesterol. It does seem to be associated with Alzheimer's.
We've got to wrap up here now pretty quickly.
Okay.
And to end, I wanted to ask you about the importance of social connection. We're learning that people recovering or living with heart disease, those connections, person-to-person connections, family and friends,
mm-hmm.
are really critical.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know of a terrific a woman, a great-grandmother in her 90s, who I think is so healthy because she is keeping in touch with people who are middle-aged people and who are very young people, and she's read all the Harry Potter books.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, what is social connection, does it have a role to play in memory fitness?
Well, there is some evidence that suggests that it may. There was a study, and I think that it was done, it may have been done in Sweden, I'm not sure about that, but there was a study that looked at the level of social support that older adults enjoyed and the level of social connections. And this can mean not necessarily having a mate that you're living with, but having a good friend that you see and having some fairly consistent and close social interaction with other people. And it was the case that that kind of high social support, close friendships, and regular social interaction was, again, associated with less memory decline than for those folks who were socially isolated.
Mm-hmm.
Related to that, just general intellectual engagement
mm-hmm.
is important. So reading, talking about what you're reading, taking a course, those kinds of things are associated with healthier memory and a lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease. And that may be the role of the social support,
yeah.
Celeste, is that it allows you to engage in that kind of intellectual and thoughtful
mm-hmm.
conversation
mm-hmm.
with somebody. Yeah.
There, we've got to wrap it up. We've strayed past our time, but I want to thank you for a really fascinating conversation this afternoon.
Les, may I add one thing very quickly?
Sure.
I changed universities at which I do my research in the past month, and I'm now at Washington University in St. Louis.
Oh, okay. So you're just down the road.
I am. I'm just down the road. I'm very close to you.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. Gil, thank you as well.
Thank you, Celeste.
Gil Einstein and Mark McDaniel are the authors of Memory Fitness, A Guide for Successful Aging. The book is published by Yale. 5 minutes before 2 o'clock, let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Settlements were relatively calm on the Board of Trade today. Celeste, let's take a look at what the numbers look like in the wheat pit. Futures finished 2.5 cents lower for the September contract. Had a high today of 324, a low at 319.5. A settlement price there at 321.25. December wheat, 337.5. The high, the low at 333.5. Settled 335. Down 2.5 cents in the March contract, off 2.75. A high today of 347.5, a low at 345, and a settlement in the March wheat at 346.5. July contract for 2005, 354 the high, the low at 351, settled 353, and they were off one for the day. From the corn pit, futures finished lower as well, down 1 cent in the nearby September contract with a settlement price at 222 and a quarter, a high of 224, and a low at 220 and three quarters. December futures, 232 and a quarter the high, the low at 229, a very narrow trading range for the day, 230 and three quarters the settlement price for the Dease corn, down 1 cent for the day. March of 05, 240 and three quarters the high, the low at 237 and three quarters, and a settlement price at 239 and a quarter, off a half cent. And the May contract finished one lower at 245 and a quarter. July corn down 1 1/4. It finished at 250 and a high today of 252, a low at 248 and three quarters. September oats, a settlement price at 127 and three quarters, off a half. Dease off a half as well, 135 and three quarters, the settlement price there. August soybeans now, 686 the high, the low at 660, settled at 665. And a half, and they were 3.5 cents lower on the day. September futures, 621, the high, the low at 598, settled 609, down 1 3/4. November, 607, the high, the low at 586, settlement price there at 597, unchanged. January futures, 612, the high, the low at 594, settlement price at 603, and they were down 1. And the May contract in the beans for next year at 620 on the high, the low at 607, settlement price at 613.5. They did finish a half cent higher. August bean meal settled at 212.70. They were up 90 for the day. And the September's finish 70 higher at 2 even. Soybean oil now, 24.24 the high, or rather 24.24 the settlement price, and they were off 25. And the September bean oil down 10 at 23.58 for the day. Here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, it was a mostly higher day today on the Merc, the exception being July bellies. August feeder cattle, 115.90 the high, 114.52 and a half the low, 115.42 and a half the settlement, that up 12 and a half. September, 115.50 the high, 114.30 the low, 115.32 and a half the settlement, that up 42 and a half. October feeder cattle, 114.45 the high, 113.25 the low, 114.27 and a half the settlement, that up 47 and a half. August live cattle, 88.70 the high, 87.20 the low, 88.47 and a half the settlement, that up 80. October, 91.72 and a half the high, 90.07 and a half the low, the settlement 90.95, that up 22 and a half. August lean hog, 76.85 the high, 76.02 and a half the low, 76.80 the final price, that up 27 and a half. October, 69.47 and a half the high, 67.35 the low, finishing at 69.27 and a half, that up 180. December, 64.10 the high, 62.70 the low, 64.02 and a half the settlement, that up 127 and a half. February lean hog, 61.85 the high, 61.20 the low, 61.72 and a half the settlement, that up 15. And July bellies, 115 even the high, 113.35 the low, and the settlement, that down the limit, down $3. The Dow is now up 111 points. At 10,073, the NASDAQ 25 higher.